What on earth did he think he was doing? What on earth did he think he was doing? What on earth did he think he was doing? Well, however you phrase it, that's the question that has been before us on a number of recent Sunday evenings. We've been looking at Jesus' words on Jesus' work, allowing him to tell us what on earth he was doing. Literally, what on earth he came to do. And tonight we come to perhaps the best known of all of Jesus' mission statements. And you'll find it in the reading Andy read for us, page 1015, Mark chapter 10. Page 1015 of the Church Bibles, Mark chapter 10. And we're going to focus on the last verse that Andy read for us, chapter 10 and verse 45. Let me read it to you again, a verse that will be well known to any old handers at Read, Mark, Learn. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. It'll be a familiar verse to some, but it's an astounding verse for us all. Because whether in this verse I'm making for you a new introduction or reminding you of an old friend, it's a verse that we can't hear too often. And so tonight I want to give you three reasons why this is an astounding verse. Three reasons why we all need to acquaint or reacquaint ourselves with this teaching of Jesus. Reason one, because of the astonishing reversal he undergoes. Because of the astonishing reversal he undergoes. Or in other words, we have here what Jesus did. And we see what Jesus did first by Jesus' use of a negative. There in verse 45, for even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And the negative is the surprise. Mark's first century readers would have expected Jesus to say this, the Son of Man came to be served. And they would have had every justification for expecting him to say that. For this title used by Jesus, Son of Man, is a title with a history. The Old Testament uses it of a very significant figure. So, keeping your finger in Mark 10, turn back to the reading we began this evening with from Daniel chapter 7, which I think only about half of us were here for anyway. But Daniel chapter 7 on page 892. Here is the prophet Daniel in a vision at night, describing what he sees. Daniel 7 and verse 13. In my vision that night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days, that is God, and was led into his presence. He was given authority and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Here is a Son of Man coming into the presence of God and given authority and glory and power. And it's honor, glory and power over, well, everyone. All people from all countries, even French farmers, speaking all languages, worship him. It's everyone. Everyone worships this one. And does it, notice, forever. Daniel 7 says that the Son of Man will be worshipped, served by everybody. Now, here's a God picture. This is something that only happens to God in the pages of the Old Testament. One with awesome authority, one with total rule, one with rule that will go on forever. And Jesus, identifying himself in the New Testament as this person, says that he'd come to be served. No, it's quite the opposite. Now, that's the shock. This Son of Man had every right to be worshipped. Indeed, one day he will be. But his entrance a first time into human history was not to receive this service by men. Here's an astonishing reversal. Instead of coming to be served, he in fact will serve. In whatever difficulties the Queen has had recently, I think if she pitched up in your office tomorrow morning, or pitched up in your college, people would still expect her to be given the most important seat. Well, how much more the expectation, then, that this Son of Man would come to be served. But Jesus says he came as a servant. And in saying that, Jesus is picking up another Old Testament portrait, that of the servant prophesied by Isaiah. So I wonder whether you turn back to the reading that we had read to us first from Isaiah chapter 53. You'll find that on page 740. And we'll see here this second Old Testament portrait that Jesus picks up and uses of himself. Here's Isaiah looking forward to a God-sent servant. Chapter 52 and verse 13 says that, "See my servant." But what will this servant do? Well, chapter 53 and verse 2, "He grew up before him like a tender shoot, like a shoot out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him." Or again, verse 3, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering, like one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, and we esteemed him not." Or look down to verse 7, "He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearer is silent, so he did not open his mouth." Until we see in verse 8, "By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living." Now there's an astonishing reversal. The glorious Son of Man, who had every right to be served, every right to receive worship from everyone, becomes a servant. Becomes this sort of servant. I wonder whether you can capture something of the climb down this is. Here the greatest becomes the least. The master becomes the slave. The Lord becomes the servant. I had to get it in somehow, so here it comes. This week Joe and I were guests at a dinner at the House of Lords. So we put on our best suits, polished our shoes, brushed our hair, and entered what is really a very ornate and opulent surrounding. But imagine as we were in the dining room of the House of Lords, that all the lords and the earls and the viscounts, that they all get up, they leave their dining table, and they usher all the waiters and the waitresses into their seats, and say, "You sit here, we'll serve you." Didn't happen, but imagine it had. The Lord becomes the servant. Simon Jenkins, a Christian poet, expresses it like this: like your landlord becoming your lodger, like your managing director up before you for an interview, like Beethoven queuing for a ticket for his own concert, like a headmaster getting the cane, like a good architect living in a slum built by a rival, like Picasso painting by numbers, God lived among us. But it's even more than that. It's not just God living among us. It's him coming to die. Graham Kendrick, in the hymn we just sang before I got up, expressed it with the words, "Hands that flung stars into space, to cruel nails surrendered." A while back, the Morning Star's banner headline ran, "The workers become the master." But Mark 10:45 describes the master becoming the worker. "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve." Our familiarity with either this verse or our familiarity with the Christian gospel can cause us to lose sight of this amazing truth: the Lord became the servant. But that leads us to a second reason why this verse is so astounding. Not just because of the astonishing reversal Jesus undergoes, but also because, second, of the redemptive substitute he was. Or in other words, why did Jesus do it? Why did the Son of Man take up this role of a servant? Why did this one who was the creator of the universe allow himself to die at the hands of those he had created? Why did this one who could have received all the worship and glory of the whole world become a servant? Well, back to Jesus' own words in Mark chapter 10 and verse 45. Page 1015 again. And listen to Jesus as he describes why he undergoes this reversal. He came not to be served but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Now here Jesus explains both the extent and the significance of his service. The extent of his service is death. But the significance of this service is a ransom. A ransom for many. His death is to be a ransom. Now the service he came to do was to give his life as a ransom. And the language of ransoming is not all that unfamiliar to us even. It's the idea of a costly substitute taking the place of a captive. So we use it in terms of hostages. Someone is taken hostage and his captors demand a ransom in his place for his freedom. An exchange. Today the ransom price seems to be arms for hostages or money for hostages. But here Jesus is saying that he becomes, in his death, a ransom price. He becomes a ransom for us, a costly substitute in our place. But we must ask ourselves, in what way are we a hostage? In what way are we captive? In what way do we need freeing or redeeming? In what sense are we in such a bad plight that we can be redeemed only by the payment of such a price? Well, our first clue comes in the price of the ransom. You see, the satisfactory price of this ransom was a life given. The costly substitute of this ransom was a life given in exchange. And so the implication is that if this Son of Man died in place of many, therefore that the many's captivity was a sentence of death. Our lives should be forfeit. His life will be sacrificed instead. And that's certainly how Jesus' Jewish hearers would have understood Jesus' words. For this idea of a ransom, this idea of a substitute, dying to redeem or dying to liberate someone under a death sentence, was part of the bedrock of the Old Testament. Now, time's not going to allow us to go through the whole of the Old Testament imagery of ransom and redemption. Haven't got time to look at the redemption from slavery in Egypt that the Israelites were given by God, or the substitute death on the Day of Atonement that he provided for them. But we will, however, look again at just one passage back in the Old Testament, and it's our passage we had read to us, Isaiah 53 again. If you've forgotten the page number, that's page 740. On a cold night, it keeps the fingers warm, if nothing else. Because here in Isaiah chapter 53, we get the description of the work of the servant. Isaiah tells us clearly why the servant died. Look, for example, at verse 5. Hear the reason why this servant died. He was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. Or again, verse 6. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each one has turned to his own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Or the second half of verse 8. He was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. Or over the page onto verse 12. For he bore the sin of many. And why did this Son of Man come as a servant and die? How did he serve us? How was his life, death, a ransom? Well, in short, it was by taking on himself the punishment we deserved. You see, the death sentence is hanging over each one of us. The penalty or judgment from a just God for our transgressions, our iniquity, our sin, as Isaiah describes it, is death. Eternal death. But the remarkable story of this servant is that he would be pierced for our transgressions. The Lord would lay on him the iniquity of us all, that he would bear the sins of many, that he would be a substitute in my place, that he would take the punishment I deserved, that he would be a ransom. So I, rightly captive to sin and its consequences, would be free or liberated, redeemed from eternal death by a substitute death, free never to have to face the eternal punishment that I deserve. We helpless, guilty captives, unable to buy ourselves free, freed by a substitute. That's brilliant news. That is very good news. But a question in your mind might be, why did it have to be this Son of Man to ransom us? Why this one who had to do the ransoming? We'll turn back to my last cross-reference to page 572. 572 and Psalm 49. And here's the explanation. Here's the explanation why it had to be this Son of Man who would be the servant, the ransom. Psalm 49 and verse 7. No man can redeem the life of another or give to God a ransom for him. The ransom for a life is costly. No payment is ever enough that he should live on forever and not see decay. You see, not only could I not get myself free from this punishment, but neither could anyone else do it for me. You see, Andy Gemmell is a very nice chap. He's a very sporting chap. Imagine he says to me, Justin, I'll take your place. I'll take your punishment. I'll die in place of you. He couldn't. Andy couldn't redeem my life. He couldn't pay for my punishment because he's got his own to pay for. He can't redeem me because he's in the same predicament I'm in. You see, it has to be someone free from captivity who can be the ransom to free someone in captivity. You remember the hostages in Beirut a year or two back now. Imagine John McCarthy and Terry Waite in the same room as they were. And Terry Waite says to John McCarthy, I'll take your place. It would be a nonsense. John McCarthy would say, you can't. You're in the same predicament I'm in. He would need somebody who's free already to take my place. You see, someone who doesn't have this death sentence hanging over them. Someone who doesn't deserve punishment. And you see, that's why only this Jesus, only this Son of Man could do it. As we sing at Easter, there was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. Now, the Muslim can't bear to think that Jesus actually died on a cross. The theory of Islam is that a substitute was found to take Jesus' place. But that's to misunderstand everything that both the Old Testament and Jesus is saying here, that he was the substitute. It should astound us, shouldn't it, that the Son of Man would become a servant. But it should further astound us that his serving is giving his life as our ransom. As one song puts it, you for me, you were innocent, I was guilty. Costly, loving sacrifice. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. That would be a good question to ask ourselves tonight. Have I allowed this Son of Man to serve me in this way? Have I allowed the ransom to be effective for me? Do I know this redemption? Do I know this certain freedom from the captivity of sin and its consequence. He came to serve. But have I allowed him to serve me? An astounding verse, because it gives us the astonishing reversal he underwent. An astounding verse, because it gives us the redemptive substitute that he was. But there's a third reason why this verse is astounding. Turn back to Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10, a third reason why this is an astounding verse, because of the exemplary illustration it provides. The exemplary illustration it provides, or in other words, it tells us what we're called to do in response. Now, for a moment or two, we need to look at the context in which Jesus is speaking. In verse 35, as Andy read to us, James and John come to Jesus with their request. They say, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." And it's Jesus' reply to this request that leads up to our verse, verse 45. Verse 45 is the concluding illustration of Jesus' answer. The total contrast between the sons of Zebedee and the Son of Man. You see, these sons of Zebedee come to Jesus wanting honour. They want to have an important seat in the kingdom. Contrasted with the Son of Man, who comes to earth renouncing his right to honour. The sons of Zebedee come with a worldly understanding of greatness. The Son of Man came to demonstrate greatness through service. Look at how the conversation runs on from verse 41. You see, when the other disciples had heard what was going on, they're fairly cheesed off. I mean, they became indignant with James and John. And so Jesus calls them all together and addresses them. And he says to them, "The world loves power. You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." Jesus, as he looks at the world, may have been thinking of the world of Rome, whose emperors had coins that were struck featuring the emperor's head with the inscription above it, "He who deserves adoration." Or Jesus may have been thinking of the world of the Herods, who ruled like tyrants. One had already executed John the Baptist. Or was he just thinking of the world where lust for power is endemic? And the world's way, our way, is that of the sons of Zebedee. Go-getters, status seekers, hungry for honour, hungry for prestige, measuring life by achievement and power over others. God's assessment is the very opposite. Verse 43, "Not so with you." In other words, Jesus' disciples are to be hallmarked by a different standard. Instead, verse 43, "Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all." For the way to the greatness and the preeminent position sought by James and John is not through the way of the world, but through the way exemplified by Jesus. Jesus is the one who became last in order to be great. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And if the kingdom principle was binding on the Son of Man, it certainly was for the sons of Zebedee. So because Jesus himself becomes the exemplary illustration of the principle of verses 43 and 44. Greatness is achieved through service. The first must become the last. That's exactly what Jesus did. And so this exemplary illustration becomes our model. To the world's way, Jesus says to us, "Not so with you." Here's the call to costly service. The extent of Jesus' service was total self-giving. For us, it's the surrender of all our rights for the benefits of our brothers and sisters. It's a willingness to place ourselves as servants of one another. You've heard me say this before, but Leonard Bernstein, the composer, was once asked which instrument of the orchestra was the hardest to play. And he replied instantly, second fiddle. Service doesn't come naturally for us. The ways of the sons of Zebedee is easier than the way of the Son of Man. You may have heard me tell the story also of Maurice Wood, a now retired bishop, but who was once the principal of Oak Hill Theological College. And one term, the cleaner left very suddenly. And so the suggestion was that all the students, just on a rota basis, would clean the lavatories. And the students said no, they had paid their fees, and their fees included cleaning. And nothing more was said, and no one knew for years afterwards how the toilets were cleaned. No one knew for years afterwards that it was the college principal who had got up every morning at 6 o'clock and cleaned them all himself. That's following the Son of Man. The model of costly service, but it's also the motivation for this costly service. For this way of service and suffering is the right way. Because the one who is ultimately the slave of all, ultimately the one who was the servant, has indeed become the greatest. God vindicates this service of the Son of Man. You see, that description of Daniel 7 of worship and honour given to the Son is now the reality of heaven and will be the scenario on the last day. The route to the glory for the Son of Man was the way of the cross of the suffering servant. But that serving is vindicated. And the principle illustrated by Jesus holds good for us too. God will resist the proud, but will give grace to the humble. He will exalt the humble. It's a constant refrain of the scriptures. The person who serves may see little reward in the present, may have little reward on this earth, but God will vindicate such service in the future. God will vindicate such service in heaven. He will show that it was right and will reward it. He will vindicate it. God has vindicated the way of the Son of Man to demonstrate to us that we must go his way of costly service to one another and go that way rather than the way of worldly power of the sons of Zebedee. It is an astounding verse, isn't it? Because it speaks to us of the astonishing reversal undergone by Jesus. The Son of Man becomes a servant. It speaks to us of the redemptive substitute made by Jesus, that he takes our place as a ransom so that we may be spared punishment for our rebellion and secure for eternity. It's wonderful news. But it's an astounding verse because it gives for us the exemplary illustration such that we'll serve one another in the way modelled for us by the Son of Man serving us. Let's pray together as we remain seated. Well, let's pause and be quiet for a moment and take the opportunity to respond to what the Lord Jesus has done for us in a moment or two of quiet. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Apart from grateful hearts, be a good question to ask ourselves whether we're one of the many tonight, and whether this work of redemption, this service, this ransom is ours, and then allow the challenge to serve one another in such a way to renounce the world's way
but follow Jesus' way, to allow that challenge to be something we want to respond to. So however, Lord, each of us has prayed in response to your word tonight, we pray that in your mercy you might hear our prayer for Jesus' sake. Amen.